villages in ruins today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. A huge earthquake along the Iran-Iraq border killed hundreds of people. Video from the region shows the countryside was hit hard.
A lady talking to the camera was saying, 21 people died in this village. We pulled them out by our own bare hands. No one came here to help us.
Plus, using a beauty pageant to raise awareness of sexual harassment and violence in Peru.
When you talk to women in my country, they don't feel safe to wear whatever they want when they're in the streets. They don't feel safe to take a cab at night.
And a French town builds a bandstand to honor a local musician lost in the Bataclan terror attack.
This is where life is springing after death or desperation.
Those stories coming up today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Natural disasters don't respect boundaries. Case in point, yesterday's magnitude 7.3 earthquake that struck along the Iran-Iraq border. The quake's epicenter was on the Iraqi side, but most of the people killed were in Iran. The death toll is in the hundreds and still rising, according to Iranian officials. G.R. Gol joins me now to talk about this disaster. G.R. is with our colleagues at the BBC's Persian service, which has been focused almost exclusively on the quake today. First of all, where have most of the casualties been, GR?
Well, most of the casualties are coming from the mountainous border Kurdish region of Iran. As I am talking to you, the number is rising hour by hour. I have received many videos and material from people underground, local journalists. Unfortunately, BBC couldn't go there. The Iranian regime doesn't allow us to go there. But we have been talking to so many contacts, so many people we know in the region. They are sending us video. It shows the region has been devastated, and particularly in the villages. And one of the video was showing a lady talking to the camera was saying, 21 people died in this village. We pulled them out by our own bare hands. No one came here to help us. Another video, a man in from another village was saying they have lost 5 people in their village. They need food. They need tents. And they said no one have come to help them. As I told you, it is a impoverished region. Even the hospital in Sarpul al-Zahab, the major city has been affected the most, is almost completely destroyed. I saw a video, tens of bodies were laid in front of the building because the hospital itself has to be evacuated.
And is the government responding to what you're hearing from people in the field, that they haven't seen any government rescuing attempts?
I think the resources from the government has been focused on the major cities. What I'm talking about is about the remote villages, which has been cut off.
Right.
Their water, their electricity has been cut off. And some of those people who are calling us, Ashi, they say nobody have reached them.
And those reports are coming from where? Social media or wire services that are able to get into those remote areas?
Well, we have many journalists, local journalists, and reliable sources within that region. They're talking to us. But what I'm talking about, I am myself actually from that region. I have family members in that region, and we have been calling them and talking to them and asking them, how is the situation? How is the response? How is the emergency servicing?
Yeah. Is your family okay, though?
They are fine, actually. Last night, they were in the major city in Kermanshah because the earthquake, yes, it shook the city. Some wall cracks, window broke. But there was numbers of earthquake with the lower magnitude before the main one, 7.2. That's why some people, actually, they got it as a warning shot. They left their houses. Possibly it has contributed to lowering the casualty. So they spent most of the night last night. They slept in their cars and outside.
So this region, just tell us a little bit about it. Is it particularly earthquake prone?
Well, the region is on Zagros Mountain. Of course, it's being built on a fault line. But in the last 100 years, actually, we didn't have such a powerful earthquake in that region. By the way, the earthquake didn't affect just Iran. It affected actually Iraqi Kurdistan as well, because exactly the epicenter is in the border, in the Ezgel. There's a small town between Iraqi Kurdistan and Iranian Kurdish region, a mountainous region. Two major cities in Iraq, Halabja and Darbandihan, were affected as well. They were as close as other Iranian city, which has lost many people. But it seems the building codes in Iraqi Kurdistan is much stronger and much better than Iranian Kurdistan. That's why we see such a high number of casualties in Iranian Kurdistan. Yet in Iraq, we only had 7 people died.
G.R. Gol reports for the BBC Persian Service. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
It's been 54 days now since Puerto Rico was hit by Hurricane Maria, and the people there are still recovering. Even today, more than half of Puerto Rico is without power. It's been called the longest blackout in U.S. history. Just a few days ago, the general in charge of the Army's emergency response to Hurricane Maria announced that his mission on the island had ended. Other agencies like the National Guard and the Federal Emergency Management Agency, or FEMA, they're staying on. Since the storm, we've been checking in with Alfredo Richner. He's a journalist based just outside of San Juan, getting updates, finding out how people on the island are coping. Alfredo, thanks for being back. How are you and your family doing?
Thank you for having me back on the show. We're doing fine. You know, we're getting through it, as we say back here.
Yeah. And just like everyday life, how is it still being affected by the destruction from Hurricane Maria? What have you now kind of gotten accustomed to?
I mean, we still don't have power at home or internet. We go to sleep really early now and wake up really early.
What did it take for you to get this Wi-Fi today for this interview?
I'm working from a nonprofit in Hato Rey in San Juan called Grupo Guayacan. I've been able to do some work from their offices.
Right, but you're trying to cobble it together. Nothing is easy right now.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
What about FEMA? Because we're seeing some criticism of that agency sending care packages of junk food like chocolate pudding and Skittles. What's being said about that? I mean, we should say, too, that Washington is defending these snack foods, and they're also saying we are sending meals ready to eat. But as for the junk food, what have you been hearing?
Some of my friends have received these boxes and had photographed them and shared them online. And, you know, you see the box and it says it has 12 fruit portions. And we can only imagine that on the Airheads candy bar is the fruit portion because it's cherry flavored.
There's no fruit.
Some of them, I've seen pictures of some of them with fruit cups, but this one specifically didn't have any. It just had chocolate bars, candy bars, Cheez-It crackers, and, you know, like canned protein. I don't know if it was turkey or something. This person had said, I've never had so much junk food in my kitchen ever until I got this FEMA package.
I've been to Puerto Rico, and in the grocery stores, even on a good day, food is a challenge. I mean, a lot of the food is imported. It's more expensive on the island than the mainland. And I would bet if mainland Americans had to pay those prices that Puerto Ricans paid, there'd be a riot. What is morale like on the island overall?
You know, a lot of people have left, so that tells you something. It's like hundreds of thousands of people. The people who stayed, I think it ebbs and flows because you want to rebuild. And there's people who are every day waking up and helping. But at the same time, it's very easy to feel downtrodden and beaten by not only the effects of the storm, but what seem to be like really systematic problems.
I've heard that some people are struggling with anxiety and depression and even PTSD. Have you seen any evidence of that?
Yeah, of course. There's been reported suicides. I think the official number after the storm came out, and it's in the double digits, it's hard.
Do you find yourself at times struggling with it too?
Yeah, when you mention PTSD, like imagine hearing there's another storm coming. It doesn't even have to be a Category 5 because this one turned into a huge storm really quickly. So I don't know what I would do if I heard that there's like a tropical storm coming. Mm. You just don't want to think about that day.
Alfredo, has there been a moment in like the last 50 days or so where you've witnessed people, maybe neighbors of yours even, they've been able to bring some light through this darkness, both the literal and figurative darkness?
Yeah, definitely. And we have this artistic community, and our scene is greatly affected because there are no venues for people to play right now. And house parties are sprouting up, which is kind of funny because, you know, you're almost 40 and going to a house party. But you know, you're mingling, you're seeing other people, and there are communal kitchens popping up. People plan their weekends around going to other municipalities and bringing food and aid to less fortunate. All that brings light into the darkness.
Journalist Alfredo Richner, based just outside of San Juan, helping us remember the struggles Puerto Ricans are going through right now. A lot of people here thinking about you, Alfredo. Thank you. And the island.
Thank you very much.
We're seeing the legacy of Vanu Bose in Puerto Rico right now, and that's good news, even though the reason we're telling you this story today is sad. Vanu Bose died this weekend of a sudden pulmonary embolism. He was 52 years old. His company, Vanu Inc., was one of the companies that helped restore some of the cell service in Puerto Rico right after the hurricane. Andrew Beard is Vanu Inc.'s chief operating officer. Vanu Bose, I understand, came from a very well-known, respected family in the tech scene here in Boston and beyond. His father founded the audio equipment company Bose, but Dr. Vanu Bose's son did his own thing. He became an entrepreneur in his own right. Can you tell us about what he did creating Vanu Inc.?
Vanu Inc. was created because Vanu saw the need to improve connectivity throughout the world, and Vanu saw ways of improving that.
Yeah, I mean, just weeks before he passed away, Vanu Inc., his company, and he kind of helped bring back cell service to parts of Puerto Rico that had been damaged by Hurricane Maria. Tell us what he actually did. I mean, what was the plan?
Basically, what we did was to take our telecommunications equipment, which are essentially very small base stations that require very little electricity and are small and lightweight, and brought them down to Puerto Rico, and people could connect to the network and obtain service from very quickly and easily.
So we're talking about Puerto Rico, but Dr. Bose worked in a lot of other communities as well, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And internationally, we're also doing a lot in Africa and in India. We've got some very significant deployments in Rwanda. We've been working with the government there and the carriers there to extend coverage using our model and this equipment. And in India, we're doing the same thing.
How did Dr. Bose articulate the need for people to be able to communicate? Like, what was his philosophy?
So that's a broad question. I think that communication is both an end in itself and a means to an end. Obviously, in Puerto Rico, people were ecstatic to get service back because they had service and then lost it. So they had come to rely on it very heavily. But it goes beyond that, because communication is now the primary means for doing a number of things in places where infrastructure doesn't support good transportation, for example. It might be the primary means for obtaining education. Mm. Banking services are now delivered wirelessly through most of Africa. And you know, those are critical services to being able to expand a business or start a business.
I see that Dr. Bose's grandparents and his mother are first-generation immigrants from India. Did that have any bearing on what he decided to do as work and what he aimed to focus his innovations on?
I think so, Marco, because, you know, Vanu, every couple of years, went to India and visited family there. And he came to know firsthand the needs of people who grew up with a different standard of living. The other thing that I think he learned was the impact that technology can have. The impact on the people and the standard of living has really been dramatic. And I think that is a lesson that was not lost on Vanu.
Andrew Beard is COO of Vanu Inc. He was telling us about the life of his late colleague and friend, Dr. Vanu Bose. An update on Lebanon's prime minister mystery, that's up next here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Lebanon's politics are always complicated, but right now, really complicated. You may recall that Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri mysteriously resigned last week while in Saudi Arabia. Some wondered if he was being held against his will as part of a proxy battle between Saudi Arabia and Iran. So yesterday, Lebanese President Michel Aoun demanded to know why Hariri wasn't being allowed to return. Hariri then did a bizarre TV interview saying he was free to return and would do so soon. The World's Rich Hall in Beirut was watching.
It was very, very strange. I watched it last night with everyone else in Lebanon, I should add. I was walking past people's houses and saw them all gathered around the same newscast. So This was an interview that was supposed to quash rumors of him being detained in Saudi Arabia. Rumors have been flying around Lebanon for the past week, suggesting that Hariri was being held under house arrest or worse by the Saudis. And this was supposed to be some sort of PR exercise to show that he was free and he was fine. So a Lebanese TV crew went to Saudi Arabia to interview the prime minister, but they weren't allowed their own crew. And the interview itself was quite bizarre. Hariri looked tired and uncomfortable. He looked exhausted. And he basically stuck to the Saudi line throughout the whole crisis. He blamed Hezbollah. But he also kind of offered a way back. He made some concessions. And there was this really bizarre moment that lots of people on social media picked up on, where Hariri was seen looking off camera to a man behind the interviewer who was holding a piece of paper. And that kind of set Twitter ablaze with people suggesting that he was being told what to say in the interview. It was so obvious, in fact, that after they came back from a break, the interviewer and Hariri addressed it, and he said, oh, this was a member of my staff. But it didn't do much to quell the rumors that he was, if not being held under duress, then being heavily pressured by Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, at that moment, it actually almost felt like a proof of life video or something.
Yeah, you were waiting for him to blink SOS or something.
Right. What was the reaction? You said a lot of people in Beirut were watching this interview. What's been reaction and the scuttlebutt since?
It's kind of disbelief, really. At first, people laughed at the rumors that he was being held by Saudi Arabia. But these, the kind of the way that's been dealt with over the past week has only fueled those rumors. He hasn't said anything for days. Yesterday was the first time in days that he'd spoken, and so that caused suspicion. He addressed that in the interview, in fact. He said that I've been quiet to allow people to deal with the shock. And the way the interview was carried out, his discomfort and these little signals, it just fueled more speculation.
I mean, it feels almost comic, but there is fear from what I gather. How concerned are ordinary Lebanese that their country might be about to get embroiled in some conflict, maybe even a new civil war between allies of Iran and allies of Saudi Arabia?
It depends on who you ask, really. There are some people who are constantly looking for signs of a war here. They're understandably highly strung after living through so many conflicts and war here. But I think on the whole, things are kind of calming down a bit. Hariri last night offered a way out of this crisis. He said that his resignation might not be permanent if Lebanon goes back to this agreement that it had before the Syrian conflict of disassociation from the region's conflicts. So what Hariri is saying is that Hezbollah should not get involved in Yemen, should not get involved in Syria, or should withdraw from Syria. And if they do that, if they isolate Lebanon from these conflicts, and if Saudi and Lebanon and Saudi's allies in Lebanon do the same, then maybe he won't resign. So that gave us a way out. And people are always kind of wary and looking for signs of war here, but I think this doesn't feel like that at the moment.
The World's Rich Hall in Beirut, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me, Marco.
The so-called Islamic State has been dealt a lot of blows in recent months, losing huge chunks of territory. But it's not just what's happening in Iraq and Syria. ISIS is also losing ground online. Its virtual caliphate has been the target of several cyber attacks, the latest on Friday, just hours after ISIS announced new security measures it said were unhackable. That didn't stop the Muslim hacking collective Dissension from publishing almost 2,000 email addresses of people subscribed to the ISIS propaganda network, Amaq. Charlie Winter is a senior research fellow at the International Center for the Study of Radicalization, and he's noticed a change in ISIS presence online.
First of all, look at what it was doing back at the peak of its activities in, say, the summer of 2015. Now, I did a study back then, mid-July to mid-August 2015. And in that 30-day period, there were over 1,000 individual pieces of propaganda. Photo reports, videos, newspapers, radio bulletins, complete media products. Wow. And the narrative itself, the thematic priorities of the propagandists at the time, it was very complex. It wasn't just looking at the military effort. It wasn't just looking at brutality that we often hear about. It was looking at a whole raft of different issues. So whether it was the provision of education or social services, propagandists basically tried to show as comprehensive a spectrum of what they wanted life to be like in that part of the world. So over 1,000. And now, fast forward a couple of years to now, it is completely different. Now it's barely managing to get out 200. The infrastructure supporting all of this has been completely crippled. It's as if someone has pressed mute on the Islamic State.
So what does it tell us when this Muslim hacking group, Dissentient, is able to grab 2,000 email addresses of people who are connected to this ISIS Amok network?
Of course, that shows that the information security side of things isn't particularly impressive. What interests me almost more than the fact that they were able to get into that is that there are only 1,700 people on that emailing list. There seem to be tens of thousands of people consuming its propaganda, tens of thousands of people willing to do what the Islamic State wants them to do. But in actual fact, it's a much, much smaller number. And if all they could manage was 1,700, then it's not just the fact that it was hacked that's interesting.
What other kind of hacks has ISIS faced?
The coalition and its partners and hacking groups like this one have been aware of the fact that if you can chuck a spanner into the dissemination network of the Islamic State's propagandists, then that will cause a significant number of problems for them. Stopping propaganda from being circulated will have an impact. Aside from all that, though, there's the kind of operational stuff. So hacking into their records. I mean, we know that the Islamic State keeps meticulous records about who's doing what in the organization, where they are, how much money they have. I imagine there's been a significant amount of stuff done to try and penetrate that operational side of it.
So what is your sense, Charlie? How big a blow have these online attacks been to ISIS? I mean, can't they just make new accounts and keep going?
Of course they can, yeah. I mean, the people who are on that mailing list, I don't think that much necessarily will come of that. But it's another blow to the Islamic State's sense of security. And of course, if you're someone that's trying to consume propaganda, talk to your terrorist mates online, and you suddenly realize that, oh, actually, maybe I'm not as secure here as I thought I was, then that will change the way that some individuals are operating. But more broadly, it's indicative of the sorry state of the virtual caliphate at the moment. What this is kind of showing is that it needs the real world stuff in order to be able to have the cyber menace that it used to have. And as the Islamic State loses more territory, it needs some way to legitimize itself, in a way to show that, yeah, we may not have the territory, but we still have the ability to perpetrate attacks abroad or inspire attacks abroad. Actually, now I think it's most desperate to incite and perpetrate acts of terrorism abroad. So it could even be more threatening now than it ever has been.
Charlie Winter, a senior research fellow at the International Center for the Study of Radicalization. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
News headlines are up next, right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. That global climate conference in Germany, it's actually being hosted by tiny Fiji.
Come on, you guys really need to hear a plea. At least have time to come down and see for yourself what we are going through. It's not our fault.
Climate change in the South Pacific, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. A song there about coal. Those were protesters today at the International Climate Summit in Bonn, Germany. They interrupted a panel on coal and natural gas sponsored by the United States. Yes, there is an official American presence at the summit, even though President Trump has promised to pull the U.S. out of the Paris climate deal. U.S. delegates are working with representatives of nearly 200 countries to hammer out the rule book for the implementation of the Paris Accord. Katie Wirth is covering the talks in Bonn for our partners at Frontline and Ground Truth. So I want to get to that event in a moment with the singing protesters. But first of all, what is the U.S. delegation actually doing there in Bonn? And is it just less visible than usual?
Yes, it's definitely got a smaller footprint than usual. Last year, Obama sent about 80 people from the executive branch. This year, there's fewer than 30. But they are here, and that's because even though Trump has vowed to withdraw from the climate accord, he can't actually do that until 2020. And in the meantime, he's sending a delegation to represent U.S. interests.
Right. A smaller delegation, for sure. Now, that protest we were hearing, that was from the U.S.'s only official event this evening in Bonn. It was a panel, as I said, promoting efficient coal and more natural gas as an answer to climate change. What was the message at that panel? And was it government officials or private industry on the panel?
It was both. It was led by a Trump administration official. The panel also had executives from the coal giant Peabody Energy, which is the largest private coal company in the world. and the industry group, the U.S. Energy Association. And they were saying fossil fuel deserves a seat at the table at Bonn, and that fossil fuels and coal are part of the solution to climate change. They say fossil fuels will be part of the equation for the foreseeable future. So to make them cleaner is the best way to mitigate climate change.
This is a climate change conference all about cutting carbon emissions, and the only U.S. event is promoting coal and fossil fuels. How did that go over with people in Bonn?
It didn't go over well. It was met with a lot of derision from environmentalists who feel the actual solution to climate change is leaving fossil fuels in the ground, especially as the price of renewable energy is approaching the price of fossil fuels. Environmentalists say it's irresponsible to continue pushing fossil fuels as an answer to climate change.
Were there people at that event who booed the United States and the people behind the table?
Yes, absolutely. About half the audience were activists who, about 10 minutes into the presentation, began singing, as we just heard. And then towards the end of the presentation, when the panel was opened up for questions, there were many questions that were kind of stinging insults of the Trump administration and questioning why they would come to this forum with that message.
So apart from this one event that the U.S. hosted, how are the U.S. delegates acting in these closed-door negotiating meetings?
Well, what I've heard is that in some negotiating rooms, the U.S. is still being considered a helpful and constructive presence, but in others, it's lost most of its clout and credibility. So, for example, one of the sticking points this year is how countries will prove they're reducing their emissions. So in other words, like on one end of the spectrum, it could work like the honor system, like a nation could be like, hey, we did it, you know, go us. And on the other end of the spectrum is kind of detailed accounting of emissions by day, by place. And the Trump delegation's position on this is fairly similar to Obama's, which is that more transparency in accounting is better. And that's, of course, because the U.S. already has all of that set up. So on this issue, the U.S. has retained its leadership role in the negotiating tables, but there are other issues where the U.S. delegation is being seen as completely obstructionist. Most importantly, that's in climate financing. So the U.S. had pledged $3 billion to the Green Climate Fund, which is a fund for small, vulnerable nations to draw on as they try to adapt to climate change. And Trump has said that he won't put another cent into that fund. And the negotiating team is taking a hard line on it. And so that's not been well received, as you can imagine, by other negotiators. And it's seen as America reneging on its promises. So in those negotiations, the U.S. has lost most of its credibility and it's being seen as obstructionist.
So if you had to sum it up, Katie, what kind of reaction has the U.S. delegation been getting from everyone else at Bonn? Polite? Ignored?
From what I'm hearing, the negotiators at the table, people are being fairly gentle with them in general because these are career diplomats. Things might change this week because this is the week when the political people arrive, the high-level ministers, and the negotiating starts in earnest. And depending on what the administration says in the full plenary, the gloves might come off.
Polite, but watch out in the next few days.
Right, exactly.
Katie Wirth reporting from the UN Climate Summit in Bonn. Here's another twist to this year's summit. It is taking place in Germany, but it's being led by the government of Fiji, the tiny island in the Pacific. They've got a lot at stake. It could be wiped out by rising seas and more intense storms. And its role in Bonn is meant to convey a sense of urgency to the summit delegates. We wanted to hear how ordinary Fijians feel about the threat to their country and about their moment in the international spotlight. So we sent reporter Sonia Narang to the capital city of Suva to hear some voices.
I'm Maria Nailevu. I'm from Taviuni Island. This is really a big opportunity to showcase to the world the reality that we are experiencing right now in Fiji, being at the front line of climate change. Any increase to that temperature will be catastrophic for the Pacific. So it's very much a big moment for us.
My name is Malakai Nalawa. I'm from the western side of the main island of Fiji, which is Vitilewe. It's for the whole Pacific island nations that we are advocating so that we can have a safe environment for all in the South Pacific.
My name is Seriana Sevutia Mudingibuli.
I'm actually proud that my government is actually recognizing this problem
that my country is hosting. The message I can say to these gigantic countries out there like the United States is, come on, you guys really need to hear our plea. At least have time to come down and see for yourself what we are going through. It's not our fault. We don't have that much industrial factories like the United States do or China does that is polluting. We never created this.
My name is Arietta Modeda. What do I hope to come out of this year's COP is increased commitment to financing. Financing mechanisms will be made much more accessible to small island states. Fiji, like other small island states, have not been responsible for the mess that we're in, but we are the first to suffer. But we're also showing that we take responsibility for whatever little spheres of influence that we have, and that any little action counts and goes a long way.
My name is Sikeli Ngonodo. There's been a lot of conferences, workshops, seminars, you name it. The big question is, when will we see action? So I hope that in Bonn, Germany, we will see action. And we want commitment from these leaders. We want to see global carbon emissions to be reduced.
My name is Jemima Bakandeambuka, and I'm from Tailevu. I think a real goal is to be able just to tell the world, hey, climate change is real, and we're facing these problems. Today, it's us that are suffering the effects, and tomorrow it'll be you. We're all in the same boat, and it's sinking.
Voices from Fiji, the Pacific Island nation that's in the spotlight this week as the leader of this year's Global Climate Summit. Our story was produced by Sonia Narang with support from the International Women's Media Foundation. Earlier this month, the 23 contestants in the Miss Peru beauty pageant did something no one was expecting. When asked for their measurements, the women recited a different set of numbers, statistics that describe the rate of violence against women in their country. For example, one contestant said that a girl dies every 10 minutes in Peru due to sexual exploitation. Another noted that more than 70% of Peruvian women are victims of street harassment. The winner of the contest will represent Peru later this month in the Miss Universe pageant in Las Vegas. Cassandra Sanchez de la Madrid is one of the coordinators for the Miss Peru competition.
Peru in Latin America is the worst country when it comes to violence against women and violence in general. When you talk to women in my country, they don't feel safe to wear whatever they want when they're in the streets. They don't feel safe to take a cab at night. They don't feel safe to just be themselves and get to places on a normal way. Let's say you can go to the police and you can say, I've been abused, I've been mistreated by a family member or my partner, but it stays there. And legally, our government hasn't done anything about it. So when we told our contestants that they were going to make a stand against violence, they were very happy because they wanted their voices to be heard.
The contestants were eager to do this, even though it was completely bucking the trend and the tradition of the pageant.
They were really happy to do this. It's just our pageant normally breaks standards. Last year, we were the first Latin American country that introduced the possibility of having a plus-size model compete. And these pageants normally have standard measurements for what beauty means or what beauty is. Normally, what we do is try to break those stereotypes because we believe that beauty has really depends on who looks at the person and what they like or what they don't like. So we started with having our first plus-size model. And then we decided that we should be a platform that empowers women to break certain topics that are not talked about. And now that we've come up with this idea to make it a public matter and have women talk about the problem they're suffering on a daily basis, now people are starting to say, okay, we need to make changes.
It sounds like Peru is breaking the kind of Miss Universe trend. Are you an outlier when it comes to the Miss Universe pageant and being kind of activists instead of beauty queens?
Actually, Miss Universe has changed a lot in the last couple of years, and they're looking for exactly that. They're looking to empower women and not look for one certain type of beauty. They're looking for a universal beauty that is willing to work for a year and change what people normally conceive as a beauty queen.
Yeah, so what was that like in I don't know, was it a theater or an arena when this happened? And what was the reaction from the audience when they started hearing these numbers?
They were shocked. I remember being backstage with the producers of the show, and everybody was silent at the beginning because they started clapping when they thought they were going to talk about measurements. But then when they heard one of our candidates say the number of women that were abused because of human trafficking in the jungle. They couldn't clap because they didn't know how to react. But as other candidates started to come up to the microphone and say other statistics, they realized, yes, it's something to be ashamed of, but it's something to be proud of. A woman stands before you and says, this is an actual problem that has a, that needs a solution, and we need to find a solution now. But the problem with what we did, well, not the problem, but what our candidates felt is when the show ended, we had our winner, everybody was happy. It was a happy moment. They came up to us and they're like, everybody's telling us it was great, but when do we know that it worked?
Yeah, I was going to ask you that. What kind of impact, like in the next year or so, would you like to be looking for?
I think that what we would like to have as an organization is next year, when we do the pageant, actually see the impact of the change and the work we've put into reducing those statistics. I think our goal with sharing them is if we could actually indicate the amount of statistics that actually went down for next year. And that's what we're hoping for.
So you're traveling to the Miss Universe competition with a Miss Peru contestant. Do you want to duplicate what you did in Lima for the big pageant? Or was there a conversation you just wanted to start there in Peru that began, and for right now, that success?
Well, Miss Mexico, she was saying that she applauds the Miss Peru initiative and that she wants to be one of the spokesperson for the cause. And she will talk about it in her final interview and in different aspects of the pageant.
Cassandra Sanchez de la Madrid is the commercial coordinator for the Miss Peru competition. Thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thank you, Marco.
President Trump is wrapping up his 12-day tour of Asia. But just as the president gets ready to fly back to Washington, the Pentagon is busy putting on a show of force in the region, a joint military exercise with South Korea in the Sea of Japan. Consider it a not-so-subtle message to North Korea, with not one but three U.S. aircraft carriers taking part. My BBC colleague Rupert Wingfield Hayes managed to get a seat on a Navy plane headed for one of them.
We're heading out into the Sea of Japan. Somewhere out there is the USS Ronald Reagan. We are going to land on board. Okay, we are very low. You can hear the engine surging. We're about to land. And we're down. The sun is just rising over the Sea of Japan. I'm standing on the flight deck of the USS Ronald Reagan. To the west of us, I can see the USS Nimitz about a few hundred meters off. And on the other side, I can see the USS Theodore Roosevelt a few hundred meters in the other direction. Nothing like this has been seen here. Well, in the Western Pacific, 10 years ago, off the Korean Peninsula, no one can really remember the last time something like this happened.
Gordon, straight deck, lens primer, requesting green deck for event 5, recommend green deck.
Green deck.
Green deck, aye, sir.
On the ship's bridge, Captain Buzz Donnelly is in command of this 100,000-ton vessel. I ask him what it means having three carriers out here operating together.
We can sustain 24-hour operations for extended periods of time. However, with more than one carrier, that length of time goes out indefinitely, quite frankly, when we get to three.
In other words, there is now enough combat power here off the coast of Korea to go to war. This is a very raw expression of America's unparalleled military might. And for President Trump, it sends a message to Pyongyang that if it doesn't come to the negotiating table, this is potentially what it faces.
The BBC's Rupert Wingfield Hayes there reporting from aboard the USS Ronald Reagan in the Sea of Japan.
Claire Camax. Nicolas Catina, Baptiste Chevreau.
The names of the victims being read aloud in Paris this morning, victims of the ISIS attacks in the French capital exactly 2 years ago today. 130 people were killed, but many people who lost loved ones that night are still coming up with creative and positive ways to honor their memories. Adeline Sia has our story.
It's cold and foggy today in the Burgundy town of Tonnerre, but in the heart of the public park, lined with chestnut trees, a new structure stands out. It's a renovated music pavilion, a bandstand. It's called Kiosque Baptiste Chevreau. It's named after a 24-year-old musician who was killed during the attack at the Bataclan Theater in Paris. Chevreau grew up in Tonnerre and played guitar, so his mother, Philomène Petitjean, says there's good reason to make this bandstand serve as memorial for her son.
Quand il était au lycée, il venait souvent sur le patis et il venait souvent sur le kiosque. Il venait jouer aux cartes, il venait jouer de la musique. Il venait...
When he was in high school, she said, he'd often come to the park and the bandstand. He'd play cards, play music, talk with other kids. I'm sure he wasn't doing his homework, but he did everything else with his friends. So choosing to restore this bandstand was a strong symbol for us because he loved it and he spent a lot of time here. Philomène Petitjean says she wanted her son to get recognition in his hometown, so it made sense to use part of the family's victims' compensation funds to rebuild the park's crumbling bandstand.
Cet argent-là, on voulait pas s'en servir pour autre chose que quelque chose.
We didn't want to use this money for any other purpose than something in the memory of Baptiste, she said. Something tangible and useful. The family also fundraised and received many donations. Thanks to old photographs and engravings, they were able to recreate the design of the old bandstand. Today, it's a beautiful pavilion with teal-colored ironworks and tiny dragon gargoyles at the top of slim columns. A lyre on the roof stands as a symbol of music, which was Baptiste Chevreau's passion. A memorial plaque reads, "This bandstand was erected against stupidity, violence and hatred, and carries values Baptiste believed in: sharing, tolerance, love of music, art and artists."
This is where life is springing after death or desperation.
Aurélia Gilbert is with the Victims Association. She's a survivor herself. She says many families have opted to use their compensation funds to create positive memorials like music festivals, for example.
Because it seems so absurd to put a value in front of the life of your close one. So, of course, it is very important because some families need compensation for supporting them, but sometimes the money seems so useless. So they wanted to dedicate that money to any project or initiative that could make the memory of their close one still alive and to bring life where there was death before.
In the park near the bandstand, banners display messages of support and thanks, and a black and white photograph of Baptiste Chevreau playing the guitar, smiling. Philomène Petitjean's husband, Patrick, says feedback and solidarity from the community helped them with their grief.
Des gens nous remerciaient, par exemple, pour le projet, parce qu'ils étaient contents d'y participer.
People thanked us for doing this, and that was very touching. Because in participating in this reconstruction project, I think affected people found a way to rebuild themselves, much as we did this to rebuild ourselves, too.
Celle-ci, elle est restée tout le long des travaux.
Philomène Petitjean says since students come to the park to hang out, she hopes the new bandstand will encourage local youth to congregate here and the town's band to perform regularly. For The World, Adeline Cyr, Tonnerre, France.
The power of music to help people heal. I bet Nick Mulvey can relate to that. He's a singer-songwriter from the UK, and while the attacks in Paris 2 years ago didn't directly inspire his latest album, the relentless news cycle of last year certainly did. His album is called Wake Up Now.
Writing an album in 2016 felt kind of impossible not to embrace some of the questions we're all living through that are now very audible and unavoidable. So the album touches upon themes like the refugee crisis and climate change and Standing Rock, but really looking at those through the lens of self-inquiry and spiritual awakening and celebration of being alive.
It's in my mind again, troubled by the images I've seen. 18 months.
This song is called Maiella. It's a song about the refugee crisis.
God only knows the pain you feel to leave your country looking for a home. But they'd rather die once in the sea than dying every day a little more.
The lyrics in it are more or less drawn from first-hand accounts of refugees' journeys, refugees talking in their own words about their experience. As a songwriter, I wanted to approach this subject. I felt really drawn to do so, but I knew I obviously had no first-hand experience and I wouldn't pretend to have that. So instead I looked at these online archives of refugees' own words. The songs touch on more political areas, but I don't think of them as necessarily political, as they are more humanitarian and spiritual. You know, songs alone don't change the world. Of course, it takes people to change the world, but songs play their role. They play their part in the formation of our attitudes and in the spreading of awareness and in giving people a space in which to process their emotions and to release some of the transpersonal trauma that almost all of us on planet Earth are going through right now, so we can have the full range of our feelings and be better humans and more unburdened people. I think music plays a role in all of this, and I'm very proud to be a musician, and I am absolutely in love and enthralled to the urges that motivate me.
See them come together, or they would not be apart. For every other day is another, and that's the only way to start.
British musician Nick Mulvey talking about his new album, Wake Up Now. We'll let more of his music take us out today. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you again tomorrow.
So many never know the difference. Come step in the dark with me. With the pale light in your hands.
PRI, Public Radio International.